This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
A cancer diagnosis is bad enough, but women with gynecological cancers still face a medical system and society that can feel too uncomfortable to understand the pain and effects of the cancer treatment. From vaginal pain, recurrent infections, to difficulty urinating, there's new research indicating women are suffering side effects from cancer treatment in silence. Good morning, Kirsten Diprose with the Conversation Hour for ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, filling in for Mary Geeran. Research by Adelaide University has found the stigma and taboo around gynecological cancers means serious side effects are being underreported and underrecognised. So how can this be turned around? And have you had a lived experience of this? Also on the program, a warning for delivery drivers with concerns over a sophisticated phishing scheme robbing drivers of their hard-earned money. And also, we know there's not much that's real about reality TV, and sometimes there's a bit of a blurring between doco and reality TV. So we celebrate the documentary this morning. What was the last Aussie doco you watched?
This is The Conversation Hour with Kirsten Diprose.
The taboo around gynecological cancers is leaving many women suffering from pain and side effects without letting clinicians even know about it. New research published in the Lancet Obstetrics, Gynecology and Women's Health is calling for the health system to address the issue as a matter of priority. Olivia Bellis is the lead author of the research and PhD candidate at Adelaide University. Hi, Olivia. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why was this an issue that you wanted to focus on?
Yeah, so in the research group that I'm in, we're focused on supportive cancer care, so specifically aiming to address cancer-related side effects, cancer treatment-related side effects. And in our research, we work with several people with a history of cancer, so lived experience experts. And in discussions we've had over time with some of these women, it kept arising that there's this lack of recognition and limited management of these gynecological related side effects. So it was just really obvious to us, it became really obvious to us that, we need to bring our attention to this and, do some research in this area.
And what sort of cancers are being affected by this taboo around speaking about these cancers?
Yeah, so gynecological side effects don't actually just impact on women with gynecological specific cancers. So we know that for breast cancer, for example, hormonal blockers that are used can cause varying degrees of vaginal dryness. Lower GI cancer, so like anal cancer, for example, can, or really any cancer that's receiving a pelvic radiation treatment, can cause this collateral damage to the vagina, and this can result in symptoms like pain, dryness, and something called stenosis, which is essentially the narrowing of the vaginal cavity.
Why is there such taboo around talking about this, even in the health system, which is really where you want to talk about it the most?
Yeah, I think the taboo that surrounds this topic comes from just general, we know that women's health in general can sometimes be overlooked and is definitely under-researched. And we know that taboo about these symptoms comes from, embarrassment from the individual. We feel like, areas, private, so to speak, areas such as the vagina or, the lower GI tract can, be embarrassing to talk about. And sometimes this isn't always front of mind for clinicians to broach in their, very short appointments that they have with patients going through cancer treatment. So all of this compounds to make it a topic that is, quite uncomfortable for a lot of people to speak about.
Olivia Bellis is with us, lead author of this research and PhD candidate at Adelaide University. Has this been your experience? Have you found it hard to raise issues with your GP, gynecological issues, or your medical team? So it's coming from both the patients who may feel uncomfortable about speaking about this as well as clinicians. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that stigma affects, you know, the population as a whole about these topics. So coming from the patient, as I mentioned, they may feel that it's not, you know, something that they can breach with their oncologist, for example. And as I mentioned, you know, our clinicians are extremely time poor in the health system. So they may feel that, you know, it might just not be front of mind for them to bring up, or even each individual might have their own stigma about talking about something that feels like it's out of their scope.
What were some of the case studies you uncovered in your research of experiences of women that perhaps went untreated with pain or discomfort for a long time?
Yeah, so in our research group, we work with women with breast cancer, vulval cancer, anal cancer as well, and these are all, you know, different cancer sites, but they are common in the fact that just irrespective of the treatment that they've received, they can have these enduring effects that, you know, to different degrees can cause, you know, pain day in, day out. It affects daily functioning, it affects ability to work, it affects even just ability to, you know, sit down or do daily activities that otherwise would be, you know, easy to do for the average person.
1300 222 774 is our number. Text line 0437 774 774. If you feel comfortable sharing your experience, then please do. You mentioned breast cancer and how the side effects can also impact, you know, in terms of the vagina. When we talk about breast cancer, there is a lot of kind of knowledge about breast cancer in general now, and a lot of effort, whether it's fundraising or making sure women get checked, that sort of thing. Do we have that same kind of recognition when it comes to some of those gynecological cancers?
Yeah, so probably not to the same degree as breast cancer, but what's really important is that we can actually use the lessons that we have from, you know, the extensive research that has been conducted in the breast cancer space. We can use that because it is translational to these other cancer, these other gynecological cancers. So whilst it's, you know, not to the same degree researched, we can definitely use these lessons to address these issues for, you know, a range of different cancers.
On the text line, we have, I wasn't told that the three treatments for recurring cervical dysplasia would leave me unable to conceive. I was only told that pregnancy would be unlikely after I asked directly. I found patient education poor, says M in Gippsland. Gosh, that's a very important conversation that you'd be wanting your clinician to have with you. You find absolutely that that is something that has also come out in your research, Olivia?
About fertility specifically?
Fertility, if it's not fertility, you know, really important things that can affect your well-being and long-term health.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that cancer treatment side effects are vast. So they are gynecological side effects, but they're also neurological. So a lot of women with breast cancer specifically experience, you know, long-standing brain fog. They experience long-standing fatigue. So these are all factors that we really focus on in our research, because it's, you know, fantastic that people are now living longer with cancer, that treatments are advancing, but we really want people to live well after cancer, not just, you know, survive.
So what can the health system do to improve the comfort of women with these side effects?
Yeah, so things like patient-reported outcome measures, which are essentially screening tools, they can be implemented into routine care, even to the point where, you know, people can use them at home to screen for their gynecological symptoms. And this could be an important or a useful thing for patients to feel more comfortable and potentially use a segue with their doctor to bring these things up if they feel that they, you know, bringing it up might just come out of nowhere. They can use these tools as a way to broach it with their doctor.
It's interesting, isn't it? We need to break the stigma, or do we need to acknowledge that these things are difficult to talk about and therefore find ways around it, like you mentioned, that at-home test? And interestingly, we've got a text in saying, up until recently, pap smears done by doctors and nurses included a vulval health check. Now, with self-collect paps, no examinations are done. How do we weigh up the kind of comfort and... comfort of the patient, but also maybe pushing against the stigma a bit so it doesn't feel weird to talk about these things to your doctor?
Yeah, of course. Look, it's multifactorial, in what we need to do to address this issue. Like, on a societal level, we need to be able to have these conversations, you know, like we're having now on radio. We need to be able to say, vaginal dryness. We need to be able to say, anal cancer, things that may make people feel uncomfortable, but they are real factors that, people are experiencing. So I think, it comes from, many levels. It comes from society, it comes from the level of the healthcare system and the individual. And I think it's going to take a multi-pronged approach to, get to a stage where, these are becoming adequately addressed in care.
Olivia Bellis, thank you so much for joining us and well done with your research.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Bellis there is the lead author of that research and PhD candidate at Adelaide University.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Coming up, media outlets are signing deals with AI chat companies. Will journalism be the winner? We'll be joined by Dennis Muller, media ethics expert from Melbourne University, a little bit later on in the program. Some more text messages. Gosh, imagine a doctor not telling a man that a treatment might make him impotent who is training these misogynists. Look, drivers are being warned, delivery drivers. They're being targeted by scammers in an increasingly sophisticated phishing scam. The Transport Workers Union is warning drivers, especially those working for online services like Uber and DoorDash, with scammers pretending to be from those organisations, impersonating support staff, and then ultimately stealing money from the driver. Apparently, these complaints have escalated in the past 6 months, and we had one driver lose $21,000. Emily McMillan is the National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thanks for having me today.
Can you start by explaining how these scams actually work?
Of course, Kirsten. So we're seeing this more and more frequently, particularly in our capital city. So it's happening with food delivery and with rideshare gig workers. So Uber Eats, DoorDash, as well as your Uber. And so what happens is, obviously, work allocation is controlled through algorithms and through apps. But once a job gets allocated, so a scammer will pretend to be a customer, then they'll have access to directly being able to contact that driver. What they do is, at that point, they then contact that driver pretending to be Uber support with a series of questions or concerns or queries, and convince the driver to just give them some basic information where they can then get into their account. And then it's quite simple, I think, at that point to get into their payment wallet. And what we've seen is different attempts then to empty out those payment wallets or have payments transferred to the scammer. So we've got people that are losing thousands of dollars. And then there's a whole really difficult process about how you get that sorted out as well with the platforms at the other end.
That's a step up from, that dodgy sounding call that wants your info for something. It does sound a little bit legitimate, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think when you've got, again, not much human interaction in these sort of, workplaces or work services, that you get this inquiry call, you think, oh my goodness, what's happened? What do I need to do? I'm being contacted by the platform as a driver. How do I sort this out? So people have kind of been giving that information. And what we're seeing is a real absence of support to navigate people through that. No training about you know, be warned, this is what's attempting to happen. But then also when that does happen, or you get a kind of red flag call or comment, really no clarity as to where you go. So we're certainly urging the platforms to work a lot closely with its workforce around what happens once those scam attempts happen.
Yes, of course, you're working with these global companies that are very much focused on customer and not so much on the contractors who work for them. Mm. How do you manage that as a union? Is it a role that the TWU actually has because of the nature of this work?
Yeah, look, exactly right. So we've really had to step in and sort of sit between the workforce and the platform with it and get those conversations happening, because traditionally these platforms don't hire many people to do this type of HR or contact functions. So we've really had to step in the first instances and say, hey, this is happening. What can we do to assist these drivers in this situation? We've recovered, you know, somewhere upwards of $50,000 for people at this point, but we have started to see work with the platforms where they're changing now what those response processes look like, but there's a lot more for them to do.
When you say you've recovered $50,000, how was it? Through the companies paying that money or through banks?
Yeah. So primarily platforms, but then at times it has to be through banks as well. But it's working with those platforms to make sure that the scammers are cut off and that money is returned to the workers who have worked incredibly hard to get that. Because again, these are workers that generally are earning significantly less than the minimum wage, don't have penalties, don't have allowances. You know, we're in the process at the moment with the Fair Work Commission of setting minimum standards finally for gig workers. But until they get that, they're working huge hours to earn very little.
Of course, we're in this cost of living crisis era where a lot of people are doing side hustles to make ends meet on top of jobs they might already have as well. Is that changing the dynamic of work?
Well, it's increasing the volume of drivers that we have that brings its own complications. You've got a lot of people whose primary job it is, but they might work across multiple platforms. And so they'll log in and they could be logged in across, you know, 12, 14 hours plus and doing different work across that and coming in and out. Then you've got those people that are doing it as their second job or their third job because of everything that's going on at the moment. But what that does is really increase the pool of workers who are then competing for work. And when it's really busy, there's plenty of work to go around. And when that's not, it's pretty savage for people. And it can be a lot of logged in time without earning a lot of money.
Emily McMillan is the National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union. So how many drivers have been affected by this latest phishing scam?
We've heard ACCC report that they've gotten over 50 complaints, I think. We're having a look at the moment. We've kind of had a few dozen come through to us directly. And as I said, it's really starting to increase. And look, I will say, the platforms are starting to respond around that. I don't have their data as to how many people have reached out to them. We're trying to work out process-wise what that actually looks like. But, I mean, if we're, you know, this is certainly getting attention because it's happening in multiple cities, and I think people are cracking onto the formula as to how to make this work. So for us, it's fairly urgent that we get out and educate all the workforce as to this is a risk, how do they stop it? But just be really crystal clear that when it does happen, what's the remedy for it? Because, you know, we've had riders and drivers that have been locked out of their payment system for weeks where either that money continues to go to scammers or they can't access their income because of it. And that's largely because there's not a person for them to talk to at the platform. So we're saying we really got to start bringing in people, not bots, because bots can't really resolve that issue. If you've been scammed and you're trying to sort that out and you're locked out of your income, you need to talk to a person.
And it's incredibly stressful as well. And bots tend to make you a little bit more frustrated, distressed, I find, in those situations.
I mean, I personally get really tense. I mean, how many times can you get asked for a security code or a password or to reset it or your email and everything else, let alone if you're just trying to access your income to do that? Or if this is your second, third, fourth language, or you've got literacy issues or a range of other issues as well around using that to communicate. But just frankly, sometimes you need to have a conversation with someone, particularly in a highly stressful situation.
And finally, Emily, what should someone do if they get a call, you know, it's from someone saying that they're from the organisation that they work for, but they're suspicious. What's the best way of going about it? Is there somewhere they can report?
Yeah, they should terminate the call and then contact their platform directly so that they're using their own number to contact that person. But also they should ring the union and talk to us as well around how we can just give them advice around these processes. And we've had thousands of gig members that have been joining the union in the last couple of years, and we encourage more to do that because we're finally winning minimum standards. We're, you know, really tackling this quite difficult, you know, set of working circumstances on across the country. So encourage people to do that. But I would say terminate that call, ring your platform, ring the union, and hopefully you can get to talk to a human.
Emily McMillan, thank you so much for joining us.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
National Assistant Secretary of the Transport Workers Union there, warning drivers about this phishing scam. Talking about the ongoing taboo and stigma around women's health and gynecological side effects after cancer treatment. Another text says, I wasn't aware that bleeding after intercourse during menopause should definitely be investigated. I thought it was just part of menopause vaginal dryness. So important that women are told to investigate any bleeding during menopause, as it may be cancer or something more serious than merely dryness. I simply wasn't aware of stage 4 cervical cancer until now. And another text says, after being thrown into chemical menopause at 46 during breast cancer chemotherapy, this was not even discussed by my oncologist. I had to seek answers myself through my GP and the Royal Women's Menopause After Cancer Clinic. Keep those texts coming. Thank you for sharing. 1300 222 774, or our text line is 0437 774 774.
774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Yes, I'm filling in for Mary Guerin. Documentaries versus reality coming up. We know reality TV, there's not much real in reality, but what about documentaries? And I want to know what a recent Australian documentary that you've watched is. Well, to media now, which should be all reality in a perfect world, but we're talking about the business of media because legacy media companies seem to be trying to take the power back from the global tech giants when it comes to their news and content. Nine Entertainment and Microsoft have recently signed an agreement to allow Microsoft's Copilot to reference Nine's journalism when it does its AI search responses. Now, this arrangement covers mastheads such as The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald and The Australian Financial Review. Dr. Dennis Muller is an expert in media ethics and journalism. He's a researcher at the University of Melbourne and joins us now. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Kirsten.
What does this mean for journalism? I mean, it means something in terms of the business model, but what does it mean for protecting real journalism?
Well, I think that in terms of protecting real journalism, all it really does is supply some money, because we don't know how much money Microsoft are paying the Nine Entertainment Company for this, but it is an injection of money, and one would hope that the Nine Entertainment Company would use at least some of it to invest more in journalism. I think that's the protective side of it. The other side of it, though, is that looking at it from a news consumer's point of view, or in particular an AI user's point of view, it's going to be drawing on, and not just drawing on, but referencing, in a sense, footnoting articles from those newspapers in its AI responses. I think that's a good thing. So long, because we can, to some extent, say that those three newspapers do, on the whole, produce reliable information. And so I think in that sense, it's good for spreading the content of basically reliable journalism. Not always reliable. There was a bit of a notorious case quite recently where the Financial Review ran a graph which purported to show the flow of preferences from to One Nation, I should say, in the South Australian election recently in May. And it turns out that two of the parties from whom the graph showed preferences flowing didn't exist, and a third party had not participated in that election. So one would hope that that the Nine Entertainment Company have learned something from that. But on the whole, I think the
was that human error or AI error?
That was AI error.
Uh-huh.
They didn't declare that. You see, the part of the problem was that when this absurdity was pointed out, they pulled the graph. But then they replace it with a little statement saying, oh, correction, this was all a bit of a mess. And in fact, it was produced by AI. They didn't declare that originally, which is another of the problems. But I think to go back to your original question, is it protective? It is, to the extent that the money that the companies get from the likes of Microsoft is then reinvested in journalism. I think beyond that, it's very hard to see what protective elements there might be in it.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, legacy media has been really fighting against these global giants in many respects, because all the revenue has effectively been flowing to Google and to social media platforms. And that's why the old business model has fallen apart for a lot of these papers, and local papers in particular have really felt it. Is this now a new revenue stream that is lucrative enough to bolster journalism?
Well, I think so. The trouble is we don't know exactly how much money was involved in this particular deal, the one between Microsoft and the Nine company. But we do know this much, that in 2024, OpenAI, you know, another AI operation, did a deal with News Corporation. And that deal was worth $250 million over 5 years. That's a pretty considerable sum of money. The details of that deal are not the same as the ones for Nine, but if you're talking about quantum, about amounts of money, I think that's probably the kind of scale we're talking about. And so, yes, if the money is reinvested in journalism and helps keep those companies afloat, then that's beneficial to journalism. But we don't, until we see the figures for the Nine deal, it'll be hard to tell.
Dr. Dennis Muller is with us. How does it work at the moment? Because obviously, if you were to type in to get your news about something or just to find out about something, it does a whole big scan of the internet, of which the Nine papers, for instance, are a part of. Is it because their information is behind a paywall that they can't really get that content? Is that what happens at the moment?
I'm not sure about that, to be honest, about whether the firewall plays a part in it. I don't think it does. I suspect that AI simply scans the content that is already in the newspapers, scans that among, or has had that fed into its large learning machine, and that it scans that material but doesn't reference it. I think the critical difference in this particular deal is that when AI comes across material in these Nine newspapers, it will then, in its answer to you, it will provide a footnote, if you like. It'll say it's come from this, and it'll publish snippets and little headlines and summaries from the papers. And I think that's the significant difference. If it actually identify the sources for you directly, you won't then have to go searching for the sources yourself. I think that's the important difference between this deal and any of the others.
That is very interesting, because then it leads a pathway back to the original article, which is really what media have been wanting ever since their business model went sideways for a long time. So that is a significant change. 1300 222 774 is our number. Our text line is 0437 774 774. Dr. Dennis Muller is with us, media ethics expert at the University of Melbourne. Interestingly, over in the UK, they're looking at the social media algorithms in terms of how news outlets can be given more visibility on digital platforms such as YouTube and TikTok. Should we in Australia be discussing this as well?
Yes, we should. I think it's of the first importance that the public are able to have as much of a look, as there should be as much transparency as possible around the use of AI. As I said at the start, public trust in AI is low. Public trust in media has been historically low, except, I should add, for the ABC. So what you have here is the risk of a kind of a multiplier of distrust. You have low levels of public trust in media, low levels of public trust in AI, and you multiply those two, you pile one on top of the other, and you see what the risk is to public trust in media. And unless we have as much transparency as possible around the relationship between AI and media, and as much transparency as we can get from the media themselves when they use AI, then I think there's a real risk that the trust in both are likely to decline. And we can't afford a further decline, particularly of trust in media, because it's fundamentally important to trust in our democratic system.
Dennis Muller, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Dennis Muller is with the University of Melbourne, a expert in media ethics. Thank you for making sense of some of the big things going on in media at the moment.
Been a pleasure, Kirsten. Thank you.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Coming up, you might scoff at the reality of reality TV, but what about documentary? Can you count on it to be real? We'll be diving into that in just a moment. But following our story at the top of the hour, where we talked about the stigma around gynecological cancer and around the gynecological pain and side effects that many women can have after cancer treatment, we've received many texts and calls, so thank you for them. And I'd like to go to Jackie now, who is on the line. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Kirsten. Thanks for taking my text.
Yeah, thank you for contacting us. Can you tell us your experience?
So I am menopausal and I was experiencing what I considered to be standard menopause-style symptoms, which included vaginal dryness. And I sort of put up with this and thought, oh, that's just part of menopause. Had a bit of bleeding, didn't think anything of it. Oh, that's just menopause. Anyhow, I finally attended a clinic with my GP and she said, look, we'll just do a pap smear, but you're well within your pap smear cycles. Anyhow, the pap smear came back positive for cancer. Mm. And the thing that I really wanted women to be aware of is that any bleeding that's unusual during menopause should be investigated, particularly if it follows intercourse, because I wasn't aware that that was a symptom that relates to a gynecological cancer. And no one never mentioned it to me. And it's not something that we think of in the same way that we know that bleeding in stools, you know, your number two, is something to be investigated. And it's really important because I've now wound up with a stage four cancer diagnosis with metastasis to my lungs because it was late stage.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. And you're in treatment now. And how's your health?
So I'm in remission currently, which is amazing, and thanks to the fabulous staff at Peter Mac, I've had brilliant medical care. But the thing is, there's a conversation at the GP level that needs to be had, which is that women need to know if they're peri or postmenopausal or during menopause, that bleeding should be investigated. It's not necessarily just menopause, and that's the message that I'd really like to convey.
Jackie, thank you so much for calling in. It was just a little bit difficult to hear you at the end there, but you got your message across very well about bleeding in menopause is you know, not normal, something you should talk to your doctor about. And indeed, even if you think something might be normal, then there's absolutely no reason why we can't ask our GP about anything. 1300 222 774, or you can text in on 0437 774 774. Thank you so much for all of these conversations this morning. And we will keep that conversation going if you would like to talk in, to text in or call in about any of our topics. Indeed, we've got quite a few as well about the media. If I can get to them, my mouse doesn't want to work. Here we go. A lot of people saying that it's a good thing that AI will be now steering people to news content. In this case, it's Nine. Another text from Annette says, hi, two high-quality documentaries that I wouldn't miss are The Things the British Stole and If You're Listening, Historical Analysis with User-Friendly Language and Clear Diagrams Video Footage, Riveting Educational and educational Television. Yes, I agree. I do watch The Things the British Stole, and it is brilliant. Sam Meikle is a writer and producer who loves a documentary, also the board member of the Australian Writers Guild and chair of Authorship Collecting Society of Australia. Welcome to the program, Sam.
Hi, Kirsten. Thanks for having me.
Wanted to talk about the difference between reality TV and the documentary, because the two genres seem to be increasingly blurred. Media Watch recently showed just how constructed Aussie Gold Hunters is, which is a very popular TV series, yeah, and with great reason. But several storylines around finding gold, or there was one about losing a dog, had been recreated for that added drama, and you know, the people in it told to, you know, sound more worried. But yeah, does this even matter? You know, if you're recreating something, is it okay?
Look, I think it's a really interesting question. I think it does matter, because I think that while there are crossovers between documentary and reality television, they actually do different things. I think documentary tends to educate and investigate and create a record of real world events, and documentaries often become part of a country or a culture's social record, and that's interrogating who we are, who we were, or who we might be. Whereas reality TV is designed to be entertainment forward, unscripted narrative, and that sort of tends to primarily be a commercial undertaking, and it highlights or it exploits our aspirations and our fears. And I think it's important to say both of them have a great place in the Australian screen, the screen business, but they do different things.
And that's a key distinction, isn't it, is that there is a lot more funding opened to documentary makers than reality TV. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And there are some very important distinctions that decide that funding. And I mean, I think Screen Australia recently released some figures that say that there's been roughly a 36% decline in doco series production in Australia since 2019. And so when that funding is allocated to documentaries, the intent is for documentary to be made rather than for reality TV to be able to access another source of funding.
To use a case like Aussie Gold Hunters, it would be incredibly difficult to have someone out 24/7 waiting for someone to find gold. Like, you know, prospectors look for months, day and night, you know, months and months, sometimes years on end without finding anything. Realistically, how it wouldn't be possible to do that. How could someone afford to film that and then piece it together?
Oh, no, I think it's a very different production model. So reality TV is designed to get a result on camera for completely understandable reasons. And they're very, very commercially successful and really well-constructed programs. But I think the difference is that those programs are constructed under financial circumstances and with money that comes in from the international market that documentaries typically are not. And that's why those mechanisms for funding documentaries are being created. It's to fill the commercial hole, to make sure that documentary stories, which, as we mentioned, have a really important educational and investigative purpose for Australian society and culture, are not left behind and are still able to be produced.
Sam Mikkel is with us. He's a writer and producer. How is the documentary sector going in Australia at the moment? Is it healthy?
Look, I mean, there is enormous intent and there's enormous production, but I mean, it's a very, very difficult environment to make stories. It's not hugely financially rewarding for the vast majority of documentaries produced, and that's difficult when they have such an important cultural purpose. So the sector really does need an injection of funding to make sure that those Australian stories continue to be told and documented.
What are some of your favourite Australian documentaries?
I mean, I will never forget seeing Rats in the Ranks for the first time. I thought that was just magnificent. I absolutely loved Gillian Armstrong's 7 Years On series that she did, which was very similar to Michael Apted's series, 7 Up, and it's just a brilliant series. I loved Cane Toads. I loved My Name is Gulpalil. The recent documentary, Harley and Catcher, was fantastic. There are so many great Australian stories told in documentary.
1300 222 774. If you'd like to share your favourite documentary, there are some great Aussie documentaries. What about the ones that change the landscape? You know, the documentary, when it's done well, can have a huge impact on how we see things. It could possibly change the political landscape even.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of the political documentary series that the ABC does with the turn of every government. So they examine every government on both sides of the ledger at the conclusion of an administration, and I think that that's a hugely helpful resource for people to be able to look back on what's happened and why it's happened politically across the ages. So I think that that is one of those. I was a huge fan of Jen Peedham's documentary Sherpa, which was told about the Sherpa community in the Himalayas, but very much was identifying and articulating, you know, lots of questions which are relevant to Australian society as much as they are to the Sherpa community in the Himalayas.
Dave Owen Castlemaine says ABC TV's In the Wild with Harry Butler was an outstanding nature doco series. If less spectacular than later BBC shows, often he'd walk up and lift a rock which had a lizard underneath and emphasise always put back things the way that you found them. I have heard that the reason that happened was that the lizard was gently glued in place before filming. I don't know about that. Really?
I mean, Les Hiddens' documentary series, Bush Tucker Man, was hugely informative.
Oh, I loved it.
and you know, it was fantastic.
Yeah. It's just funny, isn't it? The difference between reality and reality TV and documentary. Are there more industry jobs in reality TV, or is there a bigger audience appetite for reality TV?
Certainly, I would say it's a larger employer of Australian crews and Australian artists. The reality television, we make fantastic reality television. I'm a fan of a number of Australian reality TV shows, so I think it is hugely popular with Australian audiences. Some of the largest rating shows on Australian television are reality TV shows. And so great employer and also a great commercial operation for Australian entertainment as well. In terms of whether it's more popular, I certainly think reality television, because it's on mainstream television and streaming, is more accessible to most people than a lot of Australian documentaries. Once Australians see their own documentary stories, they tend to really embrace them.
We think about reality TV as being something that boomed in the 2000s or only reached our shores in the 2000s, but Sylvanian Waters was in the 1980s, and Was this reality TV or was it a documentary?
Look, I think it was right at the cusp of both. I would argue that probably one of the greatest defining factors between reality TV and documentary is that reality TV tends to be driven by relationships, but it's also often catalyzed and manipulated by the production teams. And I don't say that in any kind of derogatory sense, it's for entertainment. Whereas documentary tends to be more transparent and objective. And so I think Sylvanian Waters was right in the middle of the two, because I think it was before the age of reality TV producers who are now used to developing storylines and making sure those storylines happen, as you mentioned, say with the program Gold Hunter.
Yeah.
They were really sort of documenting this family with the things that they were doing. Whereas I think now reality TV is much more, the makers of reality TV are much more proactive in seeing that those stories unfold in a timely fashion.
And just finally, Sam, do you think there needs to be changes to the distinctions within legislation to make those two things clearer, or are they still okay where you can have that creative recreation of what happened?
Look, I think it's a question of really intent. So why is something being made? Is it an educational or investigative a take on something that is going to contribute to the sort of the social fabric of the country, or is it largely entertainment based? Because I think there is so much crossover in the techniques between documentary and reality TV, it'd be very difficult to be able to legislate that. But one thing I would say is I think that sub quotas for documentary and indeed for children's television are important to see that those sectors have an upswing in their production and their health.
Sam Meikle, thank you so much for joining us.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thanks, Kirsten.
Sam Meikle there, writer and producer, board member of the Australian Writers Guild as well. Thank you so much for having me. My time is up. I'll be back with you later in the week.